From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Gail Harris in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It was a landmark day at the Supreme Court for detainees held at Guantanamo Bay and for the Bush administration. In the first major legal challenge to the administration's use of executive power in fighting the war on terror, John Gibbons, the lawyer representing 16 of the Guantanamo detainees, argued that his clients had the right to judicial oversight, that the court had to step in and should pull back on the reins of executive power.
Respondents would create a lawless enclave, insulating the executive branch from any judicial scrutiny now or in the future.
The Bush administration legal team disagreed. Solicitor General Theodore Olson.
The United States is at war. Over 10,000 American troops are in Afghanistan today in response to a virtually unanimous congressional declaration of an unusual and extraordinary threat to our national security.
And in the war on terror, this new kind of war, Olson argued, the president needs to have the power and authority to use all necessary force to fight terrorism. There are over 600 men still being held at Guantanamo. Many have been there for over 2 years. The 16 detainees represented at the Supreme Court today are all foreign nationals, Australian, British, and Kuwaiti citizens. Next week, the Supreme Court hears the argument over the legal rights of U.S. citizens held indefinitely as enemy combatants. It's a big day and a big week at the court. The outcome of these cases could have far-reaching effects on how the United States fights the war on terror. Tonight on Point, the rule of law and the war on terror. The Guantanamo detainees put their case to the Supreme Court. We begin tonight in Washington. Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor for Slate.com and was at the Supreme Court during oral arguments this morning. I asked her if today really was the kind of landmark it seemed for the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think that's more than fair. This is going to be one of those cases that sort of defines the contours of executive power in wartime. I mean, all those big, grandiose things really are true here. This is going to be really sort of the first case in 50 years that's going to determine what the president can do with enemy combatants in wartime.
Give us an overview of the arguments, both the government's case and the detainees.
Well, like I say, this goes back to a case from 1950. So to understand the overview, you sort of need to think about the case. And the case is a case called Johnson versus Eisentrager. It was a post-World War II case involving a bunch of Nazi spies who were caught in Shanghai after the Germans had given up, but the Japanese were still fighting. They were collaborating with the Japanese. They were tried by military tribunals, never brought to the United States, no connection to the United States, and they sought a writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus just means I want to put my foot in an American court and have my claims adjudicated by an American judge. The case went all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the U.S. Supreme Court in 1950 said, no, we don't have jurisdiction over the doings of foreigners who are, you know, tried in foreign countries who have no connection to the United States. And essentially, amazingly, most of today's argument was an attempt to sort of either mash these facts in to fit Eisentrager or alternatively to say, no, that just doesn't apply today. And so you had Ted Olson, the U.S. Solicitor General, speaking on behalf of the Bush administration saying, look, this is exactly like Eisentrager. These are foreigners. They're not Americans. They were picked up on the battlefield. They are being held in outside of the United States. Same deal, no difference, no jurisdiction. We can't hear their claims. And on the other side, you have the families of these detainees. The detainees themselves are not represented by counsel. They're not allowed to have lawyers. They haven't met with the lawyers who represented them today. And their lawyers are saying this is completely different than Eisentrager. Not surprisingly, they find a whole bunch of ways to sort of distinguish the case. The big one really is, does Cuba kind of belong to the United States? Is it in our control or not? Is Cuba sort of more like Germany, or is it more like, as Justice Souter said today, the District of Columbia?
What could you pick up as to the justices' thinking on these matters from the kinds of questions that they asked?
Well, I think it's sort of split down the predictable lines. You know, Chief Justice Rehnquist, for instance, just really sort of kept asking questions that made it sound as though he didn't have a lot of patience for the notion that every single soldier who's ever picked up in wartime gets to call an American attorney. Justice Souter, for example, really made hay of the fact that this sort of argument that United States doesn't control Cuba because we have a 100-year lease on it is just bogus, and he was sort of very frustrated. At one point, he said, this is the functional equivalent of the United States picking these people up and bringing them to D.C. and then saying we don't have control. And he even said, and everyone laughed, we protect the Cuban iguana. You know, we of course are in control of that island. It's completely a legal sleight of hand to say we don't have jurisdiction there. You know, the important swing justices, of course, O'Connor and Kennedy are going to make the difference in this case. And it's hard to speculate, but they both seemed at least somewhat concerned with the sort of open-ended argument of the Bush administration that we simply get to take these people. They never get any sort of adjudication other than, you know, someone on the battlefield says that they are an enemy soldier. And then we just lock them up and throw away the key. There was a real, I think, underlying fear about when does this war end? You know, do we get to detain them indefinitely for all time? You know, this isn't like World War II or the World War II case when the war was already over. And Justice John Paul Stevens picked that up. You know, we're going to go on detaining these people possibly indefinitely. So I think there was a real feeling, at least among the two swing justices, that, you know, we have two very extreme positions to choose from, and neither of them are that attractive, but the possibility of going the way of the Bush administration and having absolutely no judicial oversight seemed to make them both at least a little nervous.
Give us a sense also, if you will, of the atmosphere of just being there. I understand there were some people who camped out overnight waiting to get in. There was a line of hundreds of people that went around the building.
It was tremendous. I mean, there were protesters. There were a lot of protesters that were sort of in very flamboyant orange prison jumpsuits that you couldn't miss, and, you know, sort of making the claim that, you know, we could sort of all be prisoners under this kind of regime. There was a lot of jostling to get into the court this morning. I think there was a real feeling that this case is going to mark a profound, profound constitutional moment in the war on terror. It really is the first time the Supreme Court is going to pass on, you know, a lot of the activities that the Bush administration has undertaken that have made a lot of people very nervous. And so there was, I think, a sense that today is sort of a momentous day and that this decision will have very, very far-reaching implications.
And is this it for these cases, or are there a couple of other cases that are going to be argued somewhat along similar lines?
Well, certainly it's it for these cases. The decision will come out sometime before the end of June. The other cases are similar but quite different in important ways, and that's the two cases that will be argued next week in front of the Supreme Court. Different because they involve American citizens. These are people who clearly have some connection with the United States. Moreover, they're being held in Navy brigs in the United States. They've also been labeled enemy combatants by the president, never charged, no trial, and they're also sort of indefinitely in a holding pattern, wondering when they're going to have their day in court. That's going to be a more complicated case for a lot of reasons, and that will happen next week.
Dahlia, thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor at Slate.com. She spoke with us from Washington. And we're talking this hour about the Supreme Court, the Guantanamo detainees, the rule of law, and the war on terror. What's your take? Should these detainees have the same legal rights as other prisoners of war, or have the ground rules changed since September 11th? Should the president be able to fight the war on terror by any means possible, or are there limits to executive power? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining me now from Washington is David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me.
Well, delighted you could join us. And also joining us from Columbus, Ohio is Mark Jacobson, visiting scholar for international security and public policy at Ohio State University. He is also the former special assistant for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served on the team that fashioned U.S. policy for those Guantanamo detainees. Hello, Mark, and welcome.
Thank you very much, Gail.
Mark, I want to start with you because you can perhaps take us inside the DOD's thinking here as to what the rules should be for these detainees, starting with the fact that, that's what they were called instead of POWs. So what is that distinction in, terms of international law?
Well, I think the important thing to remember is that neither the, Taliban nor al-Qaeda fighters were considered to have met the standards required by the Geneva Convention.
Which are?
Prisoner of war status. What that means essentially is that in order to be considered a prisoner of war, you have to meet certain standards. You wear distinctive signs. You obey the laws of war. Now, this may seem a little bit trite, but these are exactly the types of distinctions designed to protect civilians from becoming targets in war. Clearly, the al-Qaeda fighters, al-Qaeda is not a state. They were not party to the Geneva Convention. And most of the Taliban were not abiding by the laws of war during their during the conflict in Afghanistan, and certainly not in terms of the attacks on the United States. So the administration made a decision that these individuals would not be entitled to prisoner of war protections, they were not lawful combatants, and therefore they would be considered detainees. Now, it's important to note that although they did not receive prisoner of war status, President Bush did say that these individuals would be treated in a humane manner consistent with the principles of the Geneva Convention. That means detainees are provided food, clothing, shelter, medical treatment, the opportunity to worship. But what they're not permitted are certain Geneva amenities, such as a monthly advance of pay, access to personal financial accounts, and access to a canteen to purchase food, soap, and tobacco.
And apparently access to courts, since that's what they're arguing about.
Well, this is a point I really think it's important for your listeners to understand. As David Cole actually said this morning in his op-ed, what due process is may differ depending on the circumstances of detention. In the criminal system, for example, we're all familiar with what happens in terms of the right to a speedy trial. You're going to have access to counsel. But what we're talking about here are individuals who've been detained in combat on the battlefield. I think it's important to realize that if we run back to 1944 in Omaha Beach and D-Day, when the Germans were killed or captured, our soldiers weren't sitting there deciding that, we captured this person, we're going to bring him over and make sure that he has a speedy trial. No, you're detaining these individuals on the battlefield in order to make sure they don't continue to fight.
Okay, Mark, I want to ask you to hold there because I do want to get David's comments on this before we have to take a break in a couple of minutes. David, anything wrong with Mark's argument here?
Well, you know, I think if you look at Guantanamo, it probably more than anything else serves as a black mark on the United States' reputation around the world and probably has done more to undermine the war on terrorism because it has generated so much anti-American resentment. And it's not the resentment is not because people begrudge America the right to hold people who are fighting for al-Qaeda or fighting for the Taliban against us. What people are bothered by is the administration's position that we determine who is fighting for al-Qaeda and the Taliban. We don't provide any sort of hearing whatsoever, even in a military context, to individuals who have been captured, in a context where everybody knows there was a great deal of confusion. There were people being brought in by bounty hunters to claim rewards. And there's very significant chance that people who are not involved in al-Qaeda or the Taliban were locked up. And yet the United States says, because we're the United States, we don't have to abide by the rules that govern everybody else. We can simply lock these people up, throw away the key, and deny them any access to any court anywhere in the world. It's that kind of arrogance that I think really is at the heart of the world's condemnation of what we're doing at Guantanamo and is really at the heart of the problem in this case.
All right, gentlemen, actually, we don't have time before the break, but hold the thought because we do have lots to talk about here, and we'll be back shortly. We're talking this hour about the big day at the Supreme Court involving the Guantanamo detainees and the rule of law and the war on terrorism. Should these detainees have the same rights as prisoners of war, or is this a special case? And how long should they be held without charge? How do we strike the balance between national security and civil liberties in the war on terror? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking about today's landmark case at the Supreme Court involving the Guantanamo detainees, the rule of law, and the war on terror. And we're asking you, at what point do you think these detainees deserve their day in court? 2 weeks? 2 years? 2 decades? Can or should these enemy combatants, as the Bush administration sees them, be held in Cuba? And if they were U.S. citizens instead of foreign nationals being held elsewhere, how would you feel? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're talking this hour with David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism, and also with Mark Jacobson, who is visiting scholar for International Security and Public Policy at Ohio State University and was also part of the team that came up with U.S. policy for those detainees. And for only the fourth time in its history, the Supreme Court released audio recordings of today's oral arguments. In this clip, Chief Justice William Rehnquist pushes Judge John Gibbons, the lawyer representing the detainees, on one of the key points of his case, that the detainees have the right to swift judicial proceedings as stated by the Geneva Conventions.
I understand that your clients have been detained approximately 2 years.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Supposing they'd only be detained 6 months, how much would that weaken your case?
It wouldn't weaken it at all because, as we'll get into in the argument, the case depends on compliance with provisions of a binding treaty, which requires a prompt determination of their status.
So they would have had a habeas corpus entitlement, in your view, within weeks after their detention?
They would have had an entitlement to the process specified in the Geneva Convention. And if they had that process...
Did they have that right when they were in Afghanistan?
They allege not. And on this record, you have to assume that, as did the Court of Appeals.
Justice Rehnquist and John Gibbons, who was arguing on behalf of the Guantanamo detainees, 16 of them, today at the Supreme Court. And, Mark, I want to give you a chance to make the point you were going to before we took the break. And also, I want to ask you about this timing issue. Did you imagine 2 years ago that 2 years later these people would still be being held?
Sure, I'll answer both questions. I think David made some good points before the break regarding the perception that the Guantanamo Bay mission, or the impact that's had on public perception around the world. I think the administration's done an absolutely lousy job explaining why it is we've taken the measures that we have at Guantanamo Bay, and it's certainly problematic. Where I disagree with David, however, is that in a functional sense, over 10,000 battlefield or personnel captured on the battlefield, be them al-Qaeda, Taliban, suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban, over 10,000 were taken in Afghanistan. Only about 800 actually made it to Guantanamo Bay, and there has actually been in place a fairly sophisticated and meticulous screening process, because it's important in terms of getting the right people down to Guantanamo in order to interrogate them, that you only send those individuals who were likely or definitely involved in supporting or participating in terrorist activities. As to the second question, did I think we'd be here 2 years later? Absolutely. I think we're looking at a easily 3 to 5 years in terms of detention of the enemy combatants. What DOD is trying to do, obviously, is reduce those numbers. Where I do think we have a problem in terms of time is I really believe that we would have, or that the White House would have seen that more detainees by this point would have been charged with actual violations of the law of war and that the tribunals would have been started. I think that's another place where world public opinion is against us. It's taken too long to get the tribunals started.
David, what do you think?
Well, I think, you know, the government repeatedly comes up with this, well, we looked at 10,000 people and we only have 600 held there, so obviously we did a good winnowing process. But, you know, their own actions sort of belie that. I mean, when these people were brought to Guantanamo, they were called the worst of the worst, and they were people who were so evil that they would chew the transport cables on their planes to bring them down if they could. That's what the highest level people in the Pentagon and the government claimed about these people. To date, over 100 have been released. Now, if they were the worst of the worst, if they were the kind of people who would chew the, you know, cables on their transport planes to bring them down, why are we sending them back? We're sending them back because, in fact, we made mistakes. In fact, they weren't the worst of the worst. And what we have failed to do from the beginning, from day one, is to provide them a hearing that would serve to distinguish between those who were fighting for al-Qaeda and those who were not. We've done that in every other military conflict. We did it in the first Gulf War. We had 1,200 of these hearings. They're required by the Geneva Conventions. They don't have to have lawyers. They can be before military personnel. They can be fairly summary in nature, but you have to provide them. And we provided them in Iraq, 1,200 of them, and 800 of the people were determined not to be fighting for Iraq at all and were repatriated. And here, the government says, well, if they were fighting for al-Qaeda, they're not lawful combatants, and if they're fighting for the Taliban, they're not lawful combatants. But it begs the question, what if they weren't fighting for anybody at all? What if they were picked up by a Northern Alliance person to cash in on a reward that the United States was offering, and in fact they have nothing to do with it? And we've never provided the hearing that Geneva Conventions require. As to the timing, you know, Mark may be surprised that they're still there, or says, well, 3 to 5 years we might expect. That's not what Donald Rumsfeld said. When Donald Rumsfeld was asked how long can these people be kept on Guantanamo, he said until there are no longer any terrorist organizations of potentially global reach left in the world. That means al-Qaeda could no longer exist. The conflict with the Taliban could be completely over, and Donald Rumsfeld claims the authority to hold these people until terrorist organizations of potentially global reach are eliminated from the face of the earth. We all have potentially global reach these days, and terrorism has been with us before, is with us now, and unfortunately will be with us forever. And so this is a wholly unchecked power to hold people for the rest of their lives, regardless of whether al-Qaeda or the Taliban even still exist.
Well, and David, timing aside, you're a law professor. What do you see as the role of the rule of law here? Because many Americans might say, post-September 11th, hey, do whatever you have to keep us safe.
Well, I think the rule of law plays two important roles. One, of course, is to constrain the government to ensure that we have checks and balances, to ensure, for example, that when the government locks up a human being indefinitely, he has some access to a court somewhere to test the legality of his detention. That's about as basic a principle to the rule of law as ever, and it's designed to ensure that we don't have arbitrary government action. The second, I think, really important thing to keep in mind about the rule of law is that it is what gives our actions legitimacy. And it's absolutely critical that our actions are perceived as legitimate. If we had followed the Geneva Conventions, if we had followed the rule of law, if we didn't assert that we had the power to hold these people for the rest of their lives, regardless of what happens to al-Qaeda or the Taliban, and we had claimed a much more limited power to hold those who have been determined after an appropriate hearing to be fighting for al-Qaeda, I don't think there'd be much international outcry about what's going on in Guantanamo. I think people would say, yes, well, if these people have been determined to be al-Qaeda, hold them until the war with al-Qaeda is over. But we have refused from day one to do that. And imagine how we would react if some other country in some conflict unrelated to us, because remember, we're holding people of 42 different countries on Guantanamo, started picking up Americans here and there around the world and putting them on an island somewhere and saying, we're not going to give them any hearing, we're not going to give them any kind of a trial whatsoever. We've determined unilaterally through a very, very sophisticated process that they're bad guys, as President Bush puts it. I don't think we would accept that, and I don't think we should ask the world to accept that.
Well, Mark Jacobson, what about that? Does it make you squirm when you think about You know, what if this were American citizens being held elsewhere?
Well, considering that our troops don't fly aircraft into civilian buildings, and our troops abide by the laws of war and are not deliberately targeting women and children, I don't think that you can make that analogy. I also think that the United States, more so than most other nations, actually tries to abide by the Geneva Conventions, and I've been trying to rack my mind coming up with a country that we would likely be engaged in a war with that would treat our soldiers nearly as well as we would treat their fighters. I think the idea that that there are innocents who haven't done anything down at Guantanamo Bay is just plain wrong. I mean, I've read the files. I've helped to make sure that individuals who are, as they've been called, Mickey Mouse detainees, don't get down there. If I could, let me just give you an example of one detainee who's been called innocent, who's down there. This is an individual named Moazzam Beg. He's a British citizen. His family said he simply decided to move his wife and children to Afghanistan to do charity work. Well, it's pretty clear that that charity work was a bit different than most people would go through, because Beg trained in one of al-Qaeda's training camps, where he not only underwent basic training, weapons training, guerrilla warfare, but he also became an expert at in the explosives and chemical courses, including the employment of nitric acid and sulfuric acid grenades. And these are the types of individuals we have down there.
But are you saying they're all that?
Well, they're definitely not all that. I think what's important, I would characterize them in three different levels. You have everybody who made it to Guantanamo Bay was a threat. Everyone who made it to Guantanamo Bay was also either participating in, supporting, or otherwise involved in terrorist activities. Now, if somebody got picked up, said they were a taxi cab driver, are you going to take their word at face value? Absolutely not. You're going to look into it. Those individuals who were just caught in the wrong place at the wrong time were never sent to Guantanamo. I shouldn't say never. In almost every instance, we're not sent to Guantanamo Bay. Now, there may be individuals who you just don't know enough about. Well, you have two choices. You can either say, well, I don't think they're much of a threat, and let them go. I don't think that's a prudent course of action. It certainly isn't for our soldiers on the battlefield. We not only owe it to our citizens here to protect them, but when our soldiers capture someone fighting on the battlefield, we owe it to them to make sure those individuals are not simply released. And we even have had a few cases where individuals have been released from Guantanamo Bay and have gone back to fighting against the Americans.
All right, Mark, I want to get some of our – actually, David, if you will hold the thought, because yep. I do want to get some of our listeners in on the conversation. We go to Versailles, Kentucky first, where Stephen is joining us. Hello, Stephen.
Hi.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was just curious. Earlier, one of the justices was commenting on how long the war on terror could go on, and they were not real comfortable with the abstractness of how long this could last. And to me, being a justice, I think they should focus on making Congress declare war, because if you're trying to define how long a war is going to go on, we should actually be at war, and we should go back to the precepts of the Constitution that Congress has to declare war. And a lot of the current problem is because Congress and the president have circumvented that very important part of the Constitution.
All right, Stephen, thanks so much for the call. Let me put that to David, and also, David, give you a chance to complete the thought that you were about to make a moment ago.
Sure. Let me take them in turn. Mark says, if they say they're a taxi driver, we're not going to take them at their word. But he says if we say they're an al-Qaeda fighter, we have to take him at his word. We have to take Mark at his word. Mark says, well, I've looked at the files, and I've determined that these are bad guys. Or President Bush says, but that's the whole point. We can't take anybody at their word. That's why we have processes. That's why we have due process. That's why the Geneva Conventions requires a hearing where you try to assess what is actually going on, and you allow the person to be heard. And that's what we have refused to provide. So, no, you can't take anybody at their word, but that's why the Geneva Conventions requires a process. As to Congress declaring war, I think Congress effectively did declare war with respect to al-Qaeda in the authorization to use military force against the perpetrators of 9/11 and those who harbored them. That was as close to a declaration of war as we've seen since World War II, and we've fought lots of wars without declaring war. It was virtually unanimous. It was unanimous in the Senate, and one House member voted against it. But what's I think is significant is that the administration's definition of the war has always been inconsistent with what Congress gave it. The administration went to Congress and said, "Give us authority to use force, military force, against Al Qaeda and against any future terrorist threats." Congress refused that. Instead, they said, you have authority to use force against the perpetrators of 9/11 and those who harbor them in order to prevent future terrorist threats. But it was directed at Al-Qaeda. And what President Bush and Donald Rumsfeld have repeatedly done is turn that very limited authority to fight Al-Qaeda and the Taliban into an authority to fight all terrorist organizations of global reach everywhere. That's how President Bush defined it in a speech to Congress. That's how Donald Rumsfeld has defined it. And that war has not been declared by Congress. And that's a war that will never be over. And that's essentially a permanent condition, not an extraordinary situation.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join us. To Milton, Massachusetts now, we want to hear from Mike. Hello, Mike, and welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. You know, our government was formed with three separate branches of government, and they were designed to exist in a system of checks and balances. And this was carefully contemplated by the creators of our country, the creators of our Constitution. And for the detainees to be held in Guantanamo Bay and for the executive branch of government to put forward that they have a right to use United States Armed Services to detain people that is outside of a system of checks and balances is completely inconsistent with one of the most basic aspects of our country.
So, Mike, do you see this as a constitutional issue or a moral and legal issue? What?
Well, I certainly see it as a moral and legal issue. The Constitution is the ultimate arbiter of the practices of the United States of America. And whatever decision comes out of any court in the United States has to be consistent with the Constitution. So, you know, the United States Supreme Court can't say they have no jurisdiction over the executive branch.
All right, Mike, thank you so much for the call. We got your point, and I want to put it quickly to Mark before we need to take another break.
Well, I'd certainly would defer to David on the legal issue, but I think the caller misses the point. The Constitution certainly permits the United States military to act and to fight terrorists abroad, to detain those in the battlefield, and to try them through a military tribunal process. I mean, this is a time-honored tradition. This is definitely something that's not new. There have been military tribunals and commissions throughout U.S. history, and the idea that Guantanamo is this legal black hole, I think probably a bigger problem is that Guantanamo Bay, both physically and philosophically, is at the intersection of international law and U.S. domestic law.
All right, David, I do want to hear from you on that, but I'll have to ask you to hold the thought while we take a quick break. We're talking this hour about today's landmark case at the Supreme Court. What do you think? Should the court put any limits on executive power? Or should the president be able to use any means necessary to protect the United States from acts of terrorism? And how do we strike a balance between civil liberties and national security? Could the U.S. treatment of the Guantanamo detainees come back to haunt us if American soldiers are captured in future wars in foreign countries? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook, and we're talking this hour about today's landmark case at the Supreme Court involving the Guantanamo detainees, the rule of law, and the war on terror. Do you think the Guantanamo detainees are prisoners of war, as they claim? Do American legal protections reach them? And should they? Do you agree with Solicitor General Ted Olson when he says the United States is at war and that the rules have changed? What role does the rule of law play here, and what role should it play in the war on terror? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're speaking this hour with David Cole, professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens, Double Standards and Constitutional Freedoms in the War on Terrorism. Also with us from Columbus, Ohio, is Mark Jacobson, visiting scholar for international security and public policy at Ohio State University, and the former special assistant for the Office of the Secretary of Defense, where he served on the team that came up with U.S. policy for those Guantanamo detainees. Right now, though, let's listen to more of today's landmark oral arguments at the Supreme Court. The issue here is whether or not the U.S. legal system has any jurisdiction over what happens at Guantanamo Bay. Here's the Bush administration lawyer, Solicitor General Ted Olson, responding to heavy questioning, first from Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
Would this be entirely different as far as bare jurisdiction is concerned if we were talking about if the people were prisoners on Ellis Island or in Puerto Rico?
Yes, we would, because we're talking about territorial sovereign jurisdiction of the United States. What exists in Guantanamo is no different than existed in Landsberg Prison.
Why is that crucial?
It is the line that this court drew and repeatedly articulated.
But why is it a good line? I mean, what's the justification?
It is a line that has the virtue of what Justice Breyer was talking about, of having relative certainty. It is a line that's defined by state-to-state relationships.
Why does it complete jurisdiction? No one else has jurisdiction.
Yeah, well,
complete jurisdiction, a satisfactory line.
Well, the complete jurisdiction is a phrase in that lease. The lease specifically says that ultimate sovereignty is Cuba's. It specifically says that the United States...
How many years have we been operating in Guantanamo with Cuban law never applying?
Again, Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Solicitor General Theodore Olson locking horns earlier today at the Supreme Court. David, I wonder your take on this and how the argument might be different if these people were being held in Florida instead of Cuba. Do you think they would have had to have been charged by now?
Well, absolutely, and there's no question that they would have the right to seek judicial review if they had been held in Florida, and the government conceded as much. And in fact, the precise reason that they've been held in Guantanamo is to keep them in this kind of legal limbo. But the questioning that Justices Ginsburg and Souter were directing towards Mr. Olson was just basically say, look, this is a total fiction that this is Cuba. Yes, Cuba retains something called ultimate sovereignty, but we have under the lease a permanent lease that can't be broken without our consent, the kind of lease every apartment dweller would love to have. And under that lease, we have complete jurisdiction and control over Guantanamo. The only laws that apply in Guantanamo are U.S. laws. If there's an assault by one person on another, it is an American law that governs. If you have a Cuban stamp, that won't get your letter off the base. It requires an American stamp. This is essentially, for all intents and purposes, the same as holding them in Florida. That's what the question was. And therefore, ought we not, treat a duck like a duck and say that this is essentially within the territorial jurisdiction and control of the United States, and therefore they have jurisdiction. And that would distinguish people being held at Guantanamo from people being held at Bagram Air Force Base or in some other foreign country where we have a military base, but we don't have complete jurisdiction and control over the territory, and other laws apply and other courts exist.
David is joining us now from Westford, Massachusetts. Hello, David.
Hello, thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead.
Yes, I was wondering, the two gentlemen that are speaking on this issue I know are very far apart, and I'm just wondering if perhaps there's one issue that both of them would agree to, and that is that not all that is legal is really ethical, and also all that is ethical may not be legal. And I'm wondering, to me, this is not a legal issue. This is more of an ethical issue. I know that I consider myself an ethical person, not a legal person, and I would want to expect to identify with my government and my society for doing that which is ethical, regardless of the legal shenanigans that it might want to try to play.
All right, David, thanks so much for the call. And Mark, let me put that to you. Is this more about ethics than legality?
Well, I agree with the part that this really shouldn't be a legal issue. I think you can divorce the legal issues here from the real considerations, and that is, how do we fight the war on terrorism? To give you an example, if the United States had decided as a matter of policy to allow, to give all the al-Qaeda members prisoner of war status and the Taliban prisoner of war status, well, then we'd have a different issue. You could still keep them as long as you wanted to, or I should say, as until the war is over. It's a policy decision whether or not we're dealing with a war against al-Qaeda that might be finished in 5 to 10 years, or, as David correctly says, a war against all terrorism, which there will never be an end to a war on all terrorism. So I definitely think there's something to be said about divorcing some of the pragmatic aspects of this from the interesting but really, I feel, peripheral legal issues if you want to talk about how to prevent terrorists from attacking this country again.
Well, to that point, I mean, which is really the big picture point, what would you respond to those who say keeping these detainees indefinitely actually makes America more vulnerable, not less vulnerable?
Absolutely not. There are a number of things the administration has done which arguably have made us less safe on in regards to terrorism. However, you are talking about keeping individuals locked up, keeping them off the battlefield, individuals who, if you let them go, would immediately return to planning acts of terrorism. While not every one of these people rises to the level of a Moazzam Begg or a Feroz Abbasi or a David Hicks, and those are three of the worst, the individuals who have made it to Guantanamo Bay clearly have been involved in terrorism. And I think in terms of an ethical and moral responsibility, what higher responsibility than protecting the citizens of this nation?
Returning to John now, who's on the line from West Dundee, Illinois. Hello, John. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I would make this observation. I think the war on terrorism is not a war at all, because a war has to be conducted against a state or a country or some group. And terrorism in and of itself is not a group. It's an activity, illegal activity. You can have a war against terrorism like you have a war against drug abuse or a war against obesity or whatever. But that's simply part of the ongoing function of the government. It's not a separate war.
Well, and so, John, then where would you draw those lines then? Would your position be the law doesn't apply?
No, I'd say that the current law should be applied to the current prisoners in Guantanamo. I think that I believe in the judicial system that relies on judges and courts and juries, and anybody who doesn't trust a jury is essentially saying that they don't believe in the American system.
All right, John, thanks for the call. David?
Well, I think that the caller is right in the sense that of the broad sense of war on terrorism. I do think, however, that we are in a narrower military conflict with al-Qaeda. But as I've said before, you know, if no one disputes that if someone is fighting for al-Qaeda, if someone is engaged, clearly involved in terrorism, as Mark suggested, that person can be held. The point is that we can't just take Mark's word for it, and we can't just take Donald Rumsfeld's word for it, and we can't just take President Bush's words for it. Remember, he's the one who told us that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and he's the one who told us that we found the weapons of mass destruction in May after we'd gone into Iraq. So we can't take the word of any individual for it. That's why we have due process. That's why we have checks and balances. That's why the Geneva Conventions, the laws that have governed the war making, require that you provide a hearing. And if, in fact, they're clearly involved in terrorism, as Mark asserts, then the military shouldn't be concerned, because the result of the hearing will be that they can be held. So the question really is, why is the military so afraid of providing these people with the minimal hearing that we have always provided in other military conflicts, that we insist upon if our people are detained by other nations? Why can't we provide that basic hearing? And if we had provided that basic hearing, I think we wouldn't see this tremendous welling of anti-American resentment around the Guantanamo issue. And I do think that is very likely to be the real national security threat for the decades to come, this anti-American resentment that we are contributing to in the way that we have responded in the war on terrorism.
We want to go to Brandon now, who's on the line from London, Kentucky. Welcome, Brandon.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I've just got a couple comments to make. They're nothing major. One, this to David. I can tell you, I've been on the front lines with the best of them. And the United States government and the United States Army is not afraid of anybody out there. And two, I work for the Federal Bureau of Prisons. I work with these type of people all day long, every day. United States people doesn't see half the stuff that goes on behind the scenes with some of these people. These people are just ticking time bombs waiting to happen, looking for a place to happen. And I agree. You know, I haven't disagreed with anything our government has done to this point. The one thing I will agree with you on is where President Bush declared war on terrorism. There's more terrorists in our own country than there is anywhere else in the world.
All right, Brandon, thanks for the call. Let me ask Mark for a line on that.
Well, I think there are a couple interesting points raised here. There is certainly a lot beneath the surface. One of the initial criticisms of Guantanamo Bay was that individuals were being tortured, that they weren't being treated well. Well, the International Committee of the Red Cross is down at Guantanamo Bay almost on a permanent basis. They're certainly there regularly. There have been a number of congressional delegations that have gone to Guantanamo Bay. And pretty much the United States has been able to demonstrate to the world that treatment of the detainees is not an issue. Now, here's where I actually agree 100% with David. The White House should have allowed the Article 5 tribunals to take place. That would have made a world of difference. And I do want to correct something he said. The military, even though they're going to be completely loyal to the civilian administration and back them up, I don't believe the military was happy with the decision not to hold Article 5 tribunals. U.S. Central Command, who waged the war in Afghanistan, was all prepared to conduct Article 5 tribunals. President Bush made a blanket determination that anyone who was part of these groups was automatically an enemy combatant who would not meet the standards required by Geneva. I definitely think that's a mistake. However, I think David gives a little bit too much credit to the Geneva Convention. Geneva doesn't tell you how to run the Article 5 tribunals. And in fact, the way the United States probably would have done it was with a panel of three military officers, maybe five at tops. And frankly, the interagency panels of close to 20 individuals, not to mention dozens of others in the intelligence community who have looked at these cases both as they come into Guantanamo Bay and then continually assess them while they're at Guantanamo Bay. I certainly will take the word of the overall organization at face value. You're talking about individuals who take oaths to support and defend the Constitution. This is not the same as individuals who are senior political officials stating their opinions on policy decisions the United States makes.
Mark, I want to give David a chance to get a last word in here, about 30 seconds or so, David.
Well, you know, the Geneva Conventions don't say how the military tribunals have to be set up, but it does say that you have to provide them, and we have failed to provide them. I understand that the military was troubled by that because this could come back to haunt us. But the fact that 20 people have looked at it doesn't respond to the concern if there's been no opportunity to be heard. That's the minimal requirement of any kind of a hearing, is the opportunity to be heard, and that is what we have consistently denied to these people on Guantanamo, who may be the worst of the worst, but may also be innocent. We've simply never provided them an opportunity to establish one or the other.
David Cole, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David is professor of law at Georgetown University and author of Enemy Aliens. Mark Jacobson, thank you so much.
Thank you, Gail.
Mark is a visiting scholar for international security and public policy at Ohio State University. You can continue the conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on Forums. I'm Gail Harrison for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.